Okay, this is class four, the second part. Pasuk goes like this: Perek Beis, Pasuk Yud Beis. Uvhagia Torah Naro Venaro Lovei El Melech. When it came the turn of each individual girl to come to the king, Lovei El Melech Achashverosh Miketz Hayos Lo Kedos Anoshim. After she had had the rule or the regimen of the women. It's explaining here the beauty regimen that they went through before they were able to meet Achashverosh, 12 chodesh, for 12 months. Kikein yimlu yimei merukein, because that's how long it took for their cosmetic treatments. Shisha chodashim b'shemen amar, 6 months of shemen amar, b'shisha chodashim of samim, and 6 months in different kinds of aromatic perfumes. Uva tamruka yanoshim and lotions and various beauty products. Uva zeh hanar abo al hamelech. And with this, a little bit of a strange lotion with this. Uva zeh hanar abo al hamelech. The girl would come to the king. Eis kol asher toimer yinosin lo. Whatever she requested was given to her. Lova imo mi beis hanoshim ad beis hamelech. Whatever clothing or other aids or things that she felt would be helpful in making a good impression on the king was given to her when she came to the Beis HaMelech. Or we'll just read one more pasuk. Ba'erev hi ba, v'abayker hi shava, el Beis HaNoshim sheni. She came in the evening and she left in the morning. She was there till the morning. Where did she go back to? Yishavel Beis Hanoshim Sheni, to the other Beis Hanoshim. This is the second Beis Hanoshim. The first one was where they were before they met the king. After they met the king, they had a status of Pilag Shois or concubines, where they were now forbidden to be married to anyone outside, whether or not the king married them, but now they were going to remain in the palace as Pilag Shim. El Yad Shashka Tris HaMelech Shemar HaPilag Shim Lesova Yed Oid El HaMelech. They would no longer come to the king. They didn't have the rights of a queen to come and go as they pleased to the king. But they were there, and if the king wanted, he would call for them and spend time with them. So that's the pasuk. Now, the guy, very interestingly here, points out that there's a lot of extra words in the pasuk. It could have been much shorter. It could have just said that each girl had 12 months of preparation time, and then she came to the king. Instead, it has an entire arichos of agia, tarnara, venara, lova, yelamelech, achashverish, miketz, ayos lakados anoshim, shneim osa chodesh, 12 months, kichein yimlu yimei merukein, because that's how long it took. Shisha chodashim b'shem, she's on this, and then they came to the king. So, he says, and this is interesting because this is the Gaon, as you know, and the Megillah has Derech Pshat, a Pirush according to Pshat, and a Pirush according to Said, and even Remez. Said and Remez is much less of. But for some reason, he explains this pasuk, seems to me, El Derech HaSaid, but he puts it into the Derech HaPshat. So we're going to learn it, even though it doesn't seem to be Pashat Pshat. And he explains like this. He says that this pasuk obviously means, you know, it's talking about Esther and the girls of the king of that were brought to the king. But there's another meaning behind the pasuk, and it's as follows: that the naira of a naira that's being referred to here in the pasuk is a reference to the neshama of a person. Kedos hanoshim, he says like this. The neshama shenekreis na'ara, the neshama is called a na'ara, a young girl. We find other places where the Gaon uses such an idea that the neshama is considered like a young person or something feminine. And he says that there's a das hanoshim, there's the rule of the woman in this case being the neshama of a person, meaning that every person, whether he's a zachar or an akeva, a man or a woman, has a neshama, and this neshama is referred to as a naira, and there's certain rules with reference to this naira, to this neshama, in respect to what? In respect to tshuva, that a person, often everybody in this world does chatoim of various kinds, and comes Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, he davens and he cries and he asks for mechila. So the Gaon says that even if Hashem accepts the person's tefillas and the person's tshuva, but he does not erase the averis completely. He sort of puts them aside and puts them on a shelf and says, I'm not going to look at these averis. Let's see how it plays out. If at the end the person actually does a full tshuva, which means that he doesn't go back to these chatayim, and the time period for this is a year, that's when the test period is over after a year, and he doesn't go back to these chatayim anymore, so then the person has complete mechila. But if he does go back, so then the Rebbeinu Shlomo says, okay, I see that the tshuva wasn't the real tshuva, it was just a temporary feeling that a person had, or he was, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur was Ma'irim, but really, he didn't go away from this chet. And then, not only is he responsible for the new aveir that he did, but all the old aveirs come back off the shelf, and they're put back in front of him. So that's why the Gaon says that sometimes a person, for a seemingly small chet, can get a very big punishment. That's because he's getting punished for the accumulated averis of this type that he thought he had done tshuva on, but really were not completely erased ever. He brings different psukim for that. Kivachateinu uvavoinus avaseinu chorev beis hamikdash. That even for people old averis that were seemingly long gone, punishments can occur. So he explains like this. He says this is the what the pasuk is referring to, and this is the prescription, the kedos hanashim of Shnei Mar Sachodesh, is the prescription of how long it takes to do tshuva. Not only how long it takes to do tshuva, but the pasuk then gets more specific and explains the derech, the correct way of doing tshuva, so that it should be effective. This 12 months is not stam, a random number that the Rebbeinu Shlomo arbitrarily chooses 12 months. No, it's a prescription. He gives the prescription of how to do tshuva. And what's this prescription? It's shisha chadashim b'shem and amar. It's 6 months in myrrh oil. Shisha chadashim b'absamim, and 6 months in perfumes. What does that mean? What does this mean? What has this referred to tshuva? What does the oil and perfumes have to do with tshuva? So he explains like this, that shem and amar was a treatment for removing here, extra hair that woman didn't want to have, or skin that was not so nice. It was a rough, abrasive kind of a treatment. Maybe nowadays it would be similar to waxing or something. And that would take off the negative things that a person did not want to have on their body. But at the end of that period, they would have rough skin, and it wouldn't, maybe red. It wasn't so beautiful. So then they needed another 6 months in lotions and perfumes to beautify and soften and restore the skin to what it was, even more than what it was before, so that it should be beautiful and soft. So the Gaon says that tshuva works the same way. The system of tshuva is sur meira v'aseh tov. First go away from the negative, to detach oneself from the negative things that bring him to doing averis, the negative attachments, the kinds of pleasures and things that he seeks out in his life that either are themselves averis or they quickly lead to avera. That's the idea of 6 months in Shem and Hamor, that you have to sort of strip away and rub off, what's that thing called, like a lufa, to sort of abrade and remove all of the extra luxuries and pleasures that are not really necessary. Meaning, a person has to be tough on himself. For 6 months, a person has to go all the way, like it says, Minakotze Alakotze, has to go all the way to the other side and sort of work very hard on himself, even to the point of suffering a little bit and torturing himself that he doesn't have some of the pleasures and the luxuries that he's used to, because this will help him remake himself. And, an extreme example of this would be a Nazir who completely prohibits himself from wine or grapes or anything even close to that, which back then and even nowadays is one of the great pleasures, the more sophisticated pleasures, let's call it, of the world, when itself it's a pleasure and it can lead to illicit pleasures. So a nazir, a person who finds himself in a position where he's so off the rails that he has no choice anymore but to completely deny himself any connection to wine and to shikros, because that's the only way he can get a hold of himself. There's a famous story. A nazir is interesting, you know. A nazir, on one hand, he's called a kadosh, and the other hand, he's called a chayta. Gemara talks about it. He could be a chayta because he's not able to drink wine of kiddush, he's not able to do avdola properly. But there's another way understanding of it, that he's a chayta. You know, why is he a chayta? That's why he's a chayta, but he's a kadosh because he's trying to become holier. But there's another understanding, and it goes like this, that the story when the Satmar Rav was Rav in Yerushalayim, so one of his Hasidim came to him once and he said that the Rebbe, I have a relative who's getting married in Tel Aviv and I want to go to the wedding. What does the Rebbe say? He says, how could you go to Tel Aviv? Tel Aviv is a Mokim Parutz. There's all kinds of priests over there and I'm sure by the wedding it's not going to be so kosher. How could you go to such a place? So the Chassan answered him. He said, Rebbe, mir stört es nicht. I promise you that me, it doesn't bother. These things don't bother me. It doesn't affect me seeing this. So the Satmar Rav, Kedarko, didn't answer what you would expect him to answer, right? You would think he would say that, you know, yeah, Shakri and Avada affects you, even me it affects. No, he didn't say that. He said, I believe you that it doesn't affect you. But how many Averis and how many Pritzes did you have to look at to get to the point that seeing preachers doesn't affect you anymore? That's your problem. Not this particular chasana. Where are you holding, Michal? That's the idea of a nazir. A nazir needs to go all the way min akasa l'akasa to such a point, to such an extreme place that he can't even eat a grape. That's how much he has to remove himself from his negative associations. Why? Because he's so shakua, and he's done so many, he's such a drunkard, or he's so sold on drinking and on wine and everything that comes along with it, that there's no other eitzah for him but to take himself away. That's why a nazir is a chayta, not because necessarily because of the chet of not drinking wine now, because Hashem gave us the world to enjoy, which is also true. But how many chatayim did you have to do until you got to the point that you have no option but to be a nazir? But the Gaon explains that this is, again, a nazir is a prescription for someone who's really in bad shape. Other than you have an occasional nazir, like the one that Shimon HaTzadik was willing to eat from, that he did it from a totally pure place. That's a different discussion. He didn't have to do averus to become a nazir, but him, he understood that this was against this was his nesayon achayim of extra beauty. But back to our sugya. That's the idea, which that a person has to, in order to do tshuva, he has to first harshly remove himself from the negative things that are affecting his life and affecting his ruchnius. It's interesting that specifically the Shemin Amor was used as a hair remover. Hair and nails in particular are very interesting parts of a human body. They're like two parts of a body that, unlike every other part of your body, are really, they're attached to a live person, but they're actually dead. The hair itself is dead. The hair doesn't feel any pain. If you pull a person's hair, it could hurt because you're pulling, the hair is pulling the skin and the scalp. But the actual hair, I mean, the proof of the pudding is that you can cut it off and it doesn't hurt. Imagine if a person, you know, would cut his fingers the way he cuts his hair. It would be incredibly painful, right? Hair doesn't hurt when you cut it. Fingernails don't hurt. Not only that, but they are specifically, can be very attractive. You find that by that she can't beautify herself. This is one of the ways that women beautify themselves. They're a sign of those things in life that are permitted, that are mutter, but if overdone and if overly focused on, they provide a connection to death, a connection to the dark side, we can call it, right? That person gets too involved in these things, it becomes dangerous. And when you get too involved in the extra luxuries, and as life is meant to be enjoyed, everybody knows the Yerushalmi, that Hashem's going to have a taina on a person if he doesn't. Why haven't you tasted this fruit and these various things that I provided in the world? But if a person gets too attached to it, too orangutan in it, in the extras, in the luxus, in the extraneous things, such as the mashal for that would be hair and fingernails, so then he can get caught in bishaku and then just end up being caught in chet completely. And the prescription to get away from this is shemen hamar, which is a hair remover. It takes away the parts of us that are extra and that relate only to luxuries. At a more Kabbalistic level, hair and nails, you know, there's a tumor that's associated with them, right? And they're related to the I don't want to get too esoteric, but to the idea of the klipa, and that from the places of Kedusha, where these are the physical manifestations of the, let's say, the negative side of the, I don't have the right word here, just call it the tumma that's comes when a person, you know, when we do meisim, so there's always a mixture of toi v'ra. So even our good meisim can have a side effect of something negative, and that is expressed in the nails and the hair. Anyway, that's not for now, but that's the idea. So the first 6 months, a person is to do tshuva, it's shemen amar, it's a harsh treatment, it's really, really being tough on himself. The next 6 months, he has to go bibsamim. This lotions, perfumes, beauty, what's this idea? And we all know that most people have this in their life, that at different times they have a hesiris to do tshuva and to come back and to do the right thing. And sometimes a person is too harsh on himself. And after whatever period of time, doesn't necessarily mean 6 months. When the guy says over here 6 months, it doesn't have to be that way. It could be 2 weeks and it could be 3 days. Each person has to know himself. You know, sometimes we fool ourselves where we're holding. The 6 months is an overall picture. But if we're too harsh on ourselves for too long, so people can get depressed and they can get unhappy. Because a person's not really made to live that way. Most people are not able to live in this harsh regimen of total rejection of all of the world's pleasures and all of the world's geschmack. Most people need to have a connection also to the softer side, to the enjoyable side of life. And it's good. It's a good thing that Rabbeinu Shlomo put it here that we should enjoy it. Just enjoy it in the correct proportion and the correct perspective. So the guy says, that's the prescription of the pasuk. Shisha chadashim, 6 months, Hashem and Amor. Shisha chadashim, b'fsamim, over tamrukei hanoshim. This is loshes and beautiful. What does it mean in reality and practicality? It means focusing not on the negative side. I have chatasi, avisi, peshati, I'm a bad person. I have to do vidui. No, it's 6 months of focusing on the beauty, how good you are, and how good Yiddishkeit is, and what's good in it, and how to make it more geschmack, and how to make it more pleasurable, and find a minyan to daven in, where they sing, and find a place where there's a kiddush, and a place where there's a geschmack, and whatever it is that takes a person to make him enjoy Yiddishkeit more, that it shouldn't feel like a continuous burden, because we know that people are not cut out for continuously being burdened and continuously torturing themselves unless they have something wrong with them. People need to have that feeling of pleasure and belonging and enjoyment. And the emphasis is there's a way to do this, which is, most people may not believe this, but if you try it, you see it's true. You can learn to enjoy something which is not enjoyable. A lot of people say, look, I don't enjoy it. I don't enjoy learning. I don't enjoy Yiddishkeit. I don't enjoy davening. I don't enjoy whatever. A person can teach himself to enjoy something. Most things are not innately pleasurable or not pleasurable. Again, when I say most things, there's a big world out there, and some things are pleasurable for almost everybody. But a person can certainly teach himself and train himself to enjoy something, and through that he'll enjoy it. I'll give a mashal. Which tastes better, ketchup or hummus? So the answer is very simple. Talk to an American, it's ketchup. Talk to an Israeli, it's hummus. Now, it could be a person moves to Eretz Yisrael from America, like I did, and says, hey, you know what? He learns how to appreciate the good hummus. But I'll give you another example. Which is more fun to watch or follow, basketball or soccer? American football or the rest of the world's football, soccer. Again, it depends where you were brought up. Most Americans will say, oh, football is the most kishmaka sport in the world. It's so intricate. It's so, such great athletes. It's amazing. Most foreigners from almost the entire world say American football makes no sense. It's a bunch of big gorillas knocking each other down. Doesn't make any sense at all. I want to watch soccer. That's a beautiful sport. Now, it can't be that it just so happens that 300 million people that were born in America all were born with the DNA that they just enjoy watching American football. And several billion people in the rest of the world enjoy watching soccer. It just can't be, right? It makes no sense. What must it be that from each person in the country that he's in grows up with a particular sport and he watches it and he gets involved in it and he knows, he plays it and he knows who the players are and he knows how the game works and he knows the statistics and he knows what's beautiful about a great pass in American football and he knows what's beautiful about a great bicycle kick in soccer. And each person learns the things and they become pleasurable from his being mashkia in them, from his investing in them and putting time in them and getting into it. That's what makes it geschmack. And if you've grown up without it, then it's just not fun because you don't understand it and it doesn't talk to you and it's not Girsa the Yanka, so it's not what you enjoy since you're a little kid. And the pella is that it's even in tastes, which you think, what do I mean? The taste bud is a taste bud. Either something tastes pleasurable to me or it doesn't, but it's not so because you see that people enjoy the food that they grew up with and they enjoy the food of their native country. They can sometimes learn to like something else, or there are certain foods that less mandapolig, everybody loves, but there are also things that most people can't eat, and certain people say, oh, this is amazing, I love this. I mean, the hotter the pepper, the better. And most people can't even put it in their mouth. They'll end up in the hospital. So you see that, and there's many, many examples, just don't want to go too long, but you can think of your own. People end up enjoying the thing that they put themselves into and they learn about. When you're learning a subject that you don't understand at all, it's very boring. You can't listen. You can listen to somebody giving a share on it, giving a class on it. It's unlistenable. It would be like an American who loves American politics listening to somebody talk about Portuguese politics. It has no taste to him at all because he doesn't know anything about it. And it's not interesting. And he doesn't know how one thing affects the other, etc. The same thing is with Yiddishkeit. You cannot enjoy parts of Yiddishkeit, but you can also learn about it more and teach yourself to get more into it, more orangutan, find out about it, spend some time on it, make it into your ASIC, and you'll find that it becomes enjoyable. So the second half of the prescription of tshuva is that shisha chadashim b'fsamim and geshmak, perfumes, the beauty of Yiddishkeit. Some of that beauty is easy, self-evident, going to a minyan that sings a lot. Good foods, just, you know, there's things that are relatively easy to make, to take upon oneself, and they're almost instantly pleasurable. But even the parts of it that require more hashka'ah, more work, can be made beautiful if a person approaches them with an open mind and tries to find and learn the beauty in them. And that's the second half of the tshuva, and that's what the Gaon says. He says, Shisha chadashim b'shem and hamar, and with this, now you can come back to the king. Which melech? This is the melech Malchi Amlachim. This is the Kodesh Baruch Hu. After 12 months of tshuva and ma'asim tovim and learning to appreciate Yiddishkeit, now this person is a tzaddik. The next words, Eskola shatoymar yinosen lo. Whatever the person requests will be given to him. What is this a reference to? This is tzaddik goyzer HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mekayim, a person who's now a tzaddik, whose averes have now been erased for real and permanently. Now he's a tzaddik. As kol hashem toimer yinosen lo, lovei ima, to bring with him, to bring with her, mi beis hanoshim, from the beis hanoshim. What's the beis hanoshim? The beis hanoshim is this world, says the Gaon, because the beis hanoshim is a reference to the world, the house of these ladies. The ladies here is a reference to our neshamas, that from the Beis Hanoshim, the house where the neshamas have been, El Beis HaMelech, to the next world. The person is going to live his life this way. He's going to come to the next world. He's going to have everything he asked for, everything he could possibly want. There's a nice rem, as I mentioned before, V'zeh Hanai Rabo HaMelech, right? I said the Lashon is a little bit strange. V'zeh. V'zeh means with this, with what? He's not referring to a specific thing. Yeah, it's referring to tshuva. But I want to say like this. Uvazeh, I have vart on Chumash. It says like this, that when Yaakov Avinu was talking to Yosef about his two sons, Menashe and Ephraim, so it says that Yaakov lost the Ruach HaKodesh. He wasn't sure if there was a problem with the children of Yosef, that maybe they weren't worthy of becoming Shvatim, of being promoted to the status of Shvatim. And Yaakov said to him, Mi Eile Loch, who are the, no, that was the Lashon of Esau, I'm sorry. Yaakov's Lashon to Yosef was, can't remember the Lashon, I don't have a Chumash with me, but Yosef's response was, these are my sons that Hashem gave me, bozeh. Now the word bozeh is a little bit odd. It's a reference to Mitzrayim, kipshutai. Bonahem, these are my sons, Hashanosna lekim, kan, it should say here, poi, b'mitzrayim. So Rashi brings the Chazal, that in bozeh, that Yosef took out his shtaksuba and showed his father that he was married al pidin, and that the sons were actually kosher. That's one pshat, and that explains the bozeh with this. But I was thinking another pshat, that bozeh is that Yaakov was concerned whether the shvatim, whether these two sons, Menashe and Ephraim, belonged as part of the shvatim. Zeh is 12 in gematria. Zion is 7, He is 5, and Yosef was reassuring his father that bonayim, these are my sons, Ashanos Nihilakim, bozeh, that they should be in the zeh, in the 12 of the shvatim. Now, what's my smach mechatesa to say such a thing, that just because it happens to equal 12, that's a reference to the Shvatim? So I'll tell you, very simple. When Yosef went to search for his brothers, before Mechiras Yosef, so he said he went looking for his brothers, and he met the Ish Basad, he met the Malach in the field, and he said, I'm looking for my brothers. And he answered him, Nosu mizeh. They went away from this. Again, the same strange Lashon of Zeh. They went away from this. Says Rashi, they went away from the Achva, from the brotherhood. You say you're looking for your brothers? They went away from this. Again, it should say they went away from here, from Kan. No, it says they went away from this, from the Achva. You say, I'm looking for my brothers. You should know they don't consider you a brother. That's what the Malach told him. I think the Sifsa Chacham brings on the spot, that I forget who he brings it from, maybe the Chizkuni, that where do you see this merumas in the words of the Malach? Because he told them, Nasu mizeh. They went away from the zeh. Zeh, like we said, is 12. That's the 12 shvatim. They went away from the 12-ness, from the completion of having all 12 shvatim together. And you're not part of it anymore. So here, Yosef tells his father, now my sons are part of it. They're part of the 12. Not only that, you could say one more thing. How many shvatim, how many people attain the status of shvatim totally? Right? We know there's 12 shvatim. But there's a concept of 14 shvatim, because you have the 12 shvatim of the 12 sons of Yaakov plus Menashe and Ephraim. So there were 14 individuals. And you find in Svarim, it talks about the idea of the 12 shvatim and the 14 shvatim. Bozeh with the beis is 14. Bonehem Ashanos Nilielikim Bozeh. I don't want to go too long. Look in the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh on the spot. He says a very similar pshat in the Bozeh, that it's a reference to the Yaakov was questioning him. Why do you only have two sons? You're supposed to have 12. It says that Ela told us Yaakov Yosef, that Yaakov and Yosef are supposed to have the same amount of children. So Yaakov's question was, how come you only have two sons? And Yosef's answer was, Bonehem, these are my sons, Ashanosan li alakim, ba, it means beis, two. He gave me two sons, ze, instead of 12. I'm supposed to have 12, but indeed I only have two, because 10 were lost because of the 10 tipur zera that the Gemara talks, that went out by the story of Potiphera. Halkoponim is the same Yusayid, that zera refers to 12. I have a kama places where zera is a specific reference, not to the word this, but to 12. When they left Mitzrayim again, there's a beautiful pasuk over there that says they're going to go up mizeh, they're going to go out of zeh. Or Chaim on the spot says zeh means the 12 shvatim. They're going to go out together by achtus. You find that the size of a shkita knife, how many etzbois it has to be, is learned from the pasuk bazeh. There has to be 14 etzbois. So now coming back to our pasuk is mamash gevaldik. We just explained that the Goyin says this is all a reference to a person doing tshuva, and he has to have 12 months of tshuva. That's the first pasuk. Six shisha chadashim, 6 months in shemen amar, v'shisha chadashim b'absamim. That's the derech hatshuva. Uvazeh, and with this 12-ness, with this 12 months, hanayir ba'al ha-melech, the next Rosh Hashanah, the next Yom Kippur, a person comes back. The first Yom Kippur, he does tshuva. The next Yom Kippur, he comes back and he says to the Rabbani Shalom, no, how am I doing? With this 12 months, if you did the 12 months properly, and again, I stress that maybe for each individual person, it doesn't need to be specifically 12 months, but there's a concept of 12 months, of a full year, of a full turning over a new leaf. Shana, the year, means Lashon Shinui, to change. Right? With this change, with this 12 months, Hanayir Ba'al HaMelech, and the Ois Pele, who, that the Gemara talks about, that Yom Kippur, Itzume Shayoy Mechaper, right? The day of Yom Kippur itself is Mechaper. It's the Gemara in Yuma. Says Yom Kippur is Mechaper, Dechsiv, Ki Bayoyim Hazeh Yechaper Aleichem. On this day, but I will be Mechaper for you. The day will be Mechaper for you. But Bayoyim Hazeh, on this day, the Zeh, the 12 months that came in advance, that came previously, with the tshuva of 6 months of Shemen Amar and six months of Samim, that's going to be a chapar aleichem. Okay, Yashikoyach.